Hello and welcome to Behind News. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics, and no George Steinbrenner material, I promise you, today. In a few minutes, though, we'll speak with Corey Robin, who teaches at Brooklyn College, about Ayn Rand and other things on the American right. Why is Ayn Rand such a cult hero to so many? Corey, who wrote a review in The Nation magazine recently, will be able to tell us that and many other things, I'm sure. And then at the bottom of the hour, we'll be joined in the studio by Alyssa Katz, whose book, Our Lot, which is a splendid history of housing policy and our obsession with real estate and the housing bubble and the housing bust, is just out in paperback. We'll talk to her about getting an update on the housing crisis and other housing-related issues. And before all that, some words on the economic news. It's now becoming quite obvious that the burst of strength in the first quarter of the year that the U.S. economy saw has given way to something much less yeasty. The rate of job growth has slowed dramatically, and the retail sales report released earlier this week shows that Americans just haven't been spending money in the last few months with the vigor they showed in the winter and the early spring. I'm not at all surprised by this development. This is what recoveries from financial crises look like. The Federal Reserve has now come around to believing that the economy is slowing down as well. That hasn't stopped some of the more hawkish elements within the central bank from advocating for an interest rate increase to fight some phantasm of inflation that they see. But I don't think they're going to get their way anytime soon. Thank God. So the Senate passed the financial regulation bill on Thursday afternoon, sending it along to the White House for the president's certain signature. It would be an exaggeration to call it nothing, but it would also be an exaggeration to call it a major transformation of the financial landscape. The bill is named after Connecticut Senator Christopher Dodd, whose state is home to a good deal of the hedge fund industry, and Massachusetts Representative Barney Frank, whose state is home to a number of large mutual fund and money management firms. While the Dodd-Frank bill will change the way Wall Street does business to some extent, bankers headed off the biggest threats, and security analysts estimate that the hit to profits for the big banks will be well under 10%. Banks will be required to boost their capital, though this is part of a broader international effort coordinated through the Bank for International Settlements. One point, the capital requirements mandated capital in this sense means a wad of hard cash that isn't borrowed and therefore is available for tapping into in the case of a crisis. The capital requirements in this bill are in the range possessed by Lehman Brothers before it went under, so clearly having that much capital isn't much of a guarantee of anything. Some other features. Banks will be forced to stop trading on their own account, this is the so-called Volcker Rule, named after former Fed Chair Paul Volcker, and the banks will also be required to spin off part of their derivatives business into separately capitalized subsidiaries. These moves put something of a firewall between those dangerous activities and a federal safety net. But regulators will have to devise specific rules based on the legislation, an activity in which bank lobbyists will no doubt figure prominently. And the rules won't go into full effect for 4 or 5 years from now. The hodgepodge of regulators, the Fed, the Securities and Exchange Commission, the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, Controller of the Currency, to name just a few, will be left largely intact, though they will be encouraged to consult more closely. This was all less than Bush's Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson wanted to do. In a Treasury paper issued late in his term, Paulson proposed creating a single overarching regulatory authority. Insurance, very unusually in this world, will still be regulated at the state and not the federal level, which guarantees poor and very patchy regulation. Regulators will now be given the power to wind down large system-threatening institutions before they go under instead of during or after their terminal crisis. But a $19 billion levy on the banks to prepay some of the costs of such resolutions was dropped the same day that the House killed an effort to extend unemployment benefits amidst the worst outbreak of long-term unemployment in 80 years. Dropped as well was Obama's original proposal for an independent and powerful consumer financial protection agency. Instead, a new body will be created inside the Fed, an institution not previously known for its attentiveness in protecting consumers from hungry bankers. Soon after the House passed the bill the other week, Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner went on the Lawrence Kudlow's TV show to correct the perception, common in the so-called business community, that the administration is anti-business. The choice of outlet is interesting. Kudlow, a former Reagan administration budget official, is a militant supply-sider, an all-around right-winger with a one-dimensional worldview. Geithner appealed to that dimensional singularity by assuring Kudlow and his CNBC audience that the administration's plans to keep a lid on the favorable tax treatment of capital gains and dividends remained intact. And he emphasized that the president understands deeply that governments don't create jobs, businesses create jobs. The administration, Geithner continued, has a pro-growth agenda, which is a phrase that Kudlow loves to use himself. But despite all these efforts to placate capital, capital remains fairly hostile to the administration and its modest regulatory efforts, which will no doubt prompt further efforts by Obama and company to placate business, efforts that will never satisfy and will so have to be repeated and repeated. Okay, Thule Kupferberg died earlier this week. Thule was a founding member of the Fugs, that great band from the 1960s that helped pave the way for all sorts of non-standard music. And later he was a writer, artist, and a man about town. He lived to the age of 86, which is kind of surprising since he didn't exactly live like a teetotaling vegan athlete. That makes him an inspiration to all of us. A self-described Stalinist in his youth, Kupferberg became a sort of anarchist as he aged. But whatever name you want to give him, he was a witty and tireless opponent of war and greed. So, in memory of Thule Kupferberg, a bit of the track Rhapsody of Thule, and then a bit of the song Nothing, both from the Fugs' first album.
The time was 1965, and a band called the Fugs met every afternoon to rehearse at the Peace Bookstore, which was located in a former kosher butcher shop at 383 East 10th. Next door to Peace on the second floor, above the Lifschutz Wholesale Egg Market, lived a young songwriter named Thule Kupferberg. Thule worked every day composing songs on a reel-to-reel tape recorder. In the Rhapsody of Thule, we trace his work, shaping some of the startling and beautiful melodies that later graced the Fugs' repertoire. One of the Fugs' most popular songs became an anthem of its era, a sort of pre-postmodern 20th century sutra. Let's hear it for Nothing.
Tune traditional Yiddish, Bulbas. Words by Thule. New words. Monday, nothing. Tuesday, nothing. Wednesday and Thursday, nothing.
Take for an oven a garnish, giggle a job as white a garnished alone.
And that, the Fugs, featuring Thule Kupferberg, who died earlier this week, and not a bad way to live. We're now joined in the studio by Corey Robin, who teaches at Brooklyn College and did a review in The Nation recently of a couple of biographies of Ayn Rand, and I use that as a pretext to consider her contribution to American civilization and thought. Welcome, Corey.
Thanks for having me.
So, as you say in the opening of your review, Ayn Rand thought herself a writer and a philosopher, and she was really not much of either. She's extremely popular. What do people see in her?
A couple of different things. I mean, I think one thing they see in her is just the idea of a great philosopher and a great writer. Ayn Rand, in some ways, was about selling herself. That was the message. If she was great, and the things she said had to be true, and if you believed her and understood her, then you were perhaps great yourself. In fact, there's a lot of letters that go back and forth between her and her readers where they write notes to her saying things like, I'm really worried that I'm a sort of a secondhand type of person. I'm not really as great as I should be. And she would write back, well, if you understand this concept from my writings, just by virtue of that, you're a part of the elect. So I think
it's almost like touching your garment makes you great. Huh?
Exactly. And I think that was part of it, was really just being connected to her own greatness. I think the other part of it, the part that doesn't get as much play, is that she had a conception of the world where everything really in the end was a struggle between life and death. This comes out very clearly in her philosophical, or what she called her philosophical writings, but it's also in her fiction as well, that the measure of morality was the extent to which it promoted your own life or your death. And I think that image of a life or death struggle, which in the article I compare with the worldview of fascism, is very important. It gives life every moment of your life has this kind of dramatic, extraordinary quality, and it makes you the agent of your own survival or of your demise. And I think that's part of what people really find attractive is that it's a vision of the strenuous life, which as I say, she shares with a certain kind of fascist worldview.
But it also allows a lot of just regular folks to think themselves heroic in some sense, doesn't it?
Absolutely. It makes the everyday. I mean, that's part of what she's about, is making the everyday heroic and giving people, ordinary people, access to that. I mean, people think that she celebrates just elites, which she does in a way. But if you read the fiction, actually, there's also this very demotic quality to that heroism. You know, the person in the quarry can be as heroic as the person at the top floor of a corporate building. In fact, she herself was quite contemptuous of corporate CEOs and people like that, who she felt like were part of the problem.
Well, why is that not some sort of democratic impulse then, to celebrate even seemingly ordinary activities as grandiose in some way?
There is a democratic quality to it. I mean, I think people miss that. I think it is there's a way in which she gives ordinary people access to that kind of heroism. The problem with it, what ultimately makes it not about democracy at all, is that she has a vision of the world as extraordinarily unequal. There are great people and there are people who are lesser beings, the mass. The democratic part is that everybody potentially has access to being part of that great few. But ultimately, it's that great few who determine the destinies of everybody else. That's not really a democratic worldview.
And of course, your access to being part of the chosen is how much Ayn Rand you've read and subscribe to, right?
Absolutely.
Let's step back and set the scene somewhat. I do want to return to this fascist theme in a little bit. But where'd she come from?
She was born in St. Petersburg in 1905, 1906, just around the time of the Russian Revolution.
And what was her birth name?
Elisa Rosenbaum.
Where did the Ayn Rand come from?
Well, there's a lot of debate about this. In the end, she made it up herself. And I think one of the authors that I review there makes the most persuasive case that it's basically based upon some diminutive words from Russian. There was a lot of speculation that the Rand is a reference to the Kruger Rand in South Africa or something like that. But I think it was a reference to some kind of diminutive.
She and her circle are rather randy, too, weren't they?
That's true. But you know, she invented the name.
Uh-huh. And so how did she find her way here?
She escaped in 1926, 1927 with quite a bit of help from her family. This is one of the interesting stories that comes out from these biographies, is the extraordinary amount of collective endeavor that went into Ayn Rand's escape from Soviet Russia and then to her setting up in the United States eventually. She got a lot of money from her family and then also from her family in the United States when she got here, which she never paid back and never acknowledged.
So her family wasn't expropriated by the Bolsheviks?
There was some of that in the immediate between 1918 and 1920. Her father was a pharmacist and his pharmacy was requisitioned. So they did have definitely a precarious economic existence, but they were certainly better off than a lot of other people were.
And then she gets here, and what was her road to greatness?
She spent some time in Chicago, a very brief amount of time, from the very beginning. I mean, I use the word escape, and there's truth to that. I mean, it was a somewhat harrowing getting out. But it wasn't like she was going in an exile from a persecuting regime. I think she was more drawn to the United States than she was fleeing Soviet Russia. And what she was drawn to in the United States was Hollywood. That's where she went to. Within a year, she was already set up in Hollywood. And through, you know, it's kind of those quintessential Hollywood stories, she was discovered by Cecil B. DeMille on the lot. He saw this woman, you know, who was staring at him intensely, and he got to chatting with her, and she told him who she was, and he gave her a job on the lot, which she quickly turned into a screenwriting gig there.
And did she write any screenplays that got produced?
She did write quite a few. I don't remember if any of them were produced, but I think they were actually, because she started getting quite a bit of attention from some sort of big muckety-mucks in Hollywood very early on.
And then how did she find her way to being a novelist and philosopher?
Well, she always wanted to be a writer, and she started working on, you know, on the Fountainhead in the 40s, maybe a little bit earlier. She had written a couple of plays and done some other things of that sort, and had even written a novel before The Fountainhead called Anthem. But that was always her sort of great ambition, was to be a novelist. You know, she had this idea of the European novelist. Her models, though, weren't, you know, the European novelists like, you know, Tolstoy or people like that. It was, you know, more the sort of the second tier of European novelists. Victor Hugo was her great model. And she started writing, and based on her experience in Hollywood, she had sort of perfected the art of melodrama. I mean, she got to Hollywood at the time when that was really the thing, and she learned it, and she, you know, could produce a good story.
And I hope you got some hazardous duty pay for this from the nation, but you actually read her novels, right?
Yeah, well, not all of them.
Or exposed yourself to many of the pages.
I had read The Fountainhead when I was much younger, like many other people. And all I had remembered from it was the descriptions of the architecture. So I reread that, and then Atlas Shrugged I had never read. And that was, I have to say, it was pretty heavy going. I mean, I was surprised. I really went into this project thinking, okay, you know, this is an opportunity to kind of immerse myself in this world. It turned out to be, you know, much more ponderous than I had realized going into it.
But nonetheless, these books are enormous sellers, right?
Huge bestsellers, and that's
and perennially.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think the figures, you know, more recently was, you know, upwards of 500,000-600,000 copies of all her books. Yeah, no, absolutely. And you know, they've got some steamy sex scenes. They're suspenseful sometimes. The Fountainhead, I could understand more. Atlas Shrugged seems, like I said, incredibly ponderous. I'm always surprised that that one's such a seller. But, you know, it's got a couple of things to keep you turning the page. And then it has, as I said, this sort of world view.
Yeah, so as they say in the business world, what's the takeaway from these things?
Well, I mean, I think the takeaway is that, as I said earlier, that life is this, you know, is a death struggle. That's what life is all about. And it's expressed primarily through the economy. And the people who master that world will live. Those who don't will die. And rightly so.
And she had a collection of essays, which I read in my impressionable youth, about capitalism being the unknown ideal. A collection to which Alan Greenspan contributed two or three chapters.
Mm-hmm.
But it was really a celebration of bare-knuckled capitalism, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Now, what do you think is the appeal of these books? I mean, certainly the literary content, you know, even by the standards of best-selling potboilers, is rather poor.
Yeah.
So what keeps people coming back for more and more?
Well, you know, there's her understanding of capitalism, we should be clear, it's really about kind of a certain kind of heroic, titanic industrialists, creators, scientists, inventors, and the people who manage to fabricate objects. In some ways, it's a very 19th century conception of capitalism, sort of the robber barons and the Gilded Age. It's not, you know, there's no bankers.
Guys are not creating CDOs.
No, nothing like that. You know, the whole world of finance, nothing like that exists. These are men of great vision who invent things and manage to create objects, beautiful objects or useful objects that can be sold. Or, you know, so there's the creator, and then there's the person who is the trader, the person who is buying and selling. So there's a very tactile element to it all. There's a way in which you could fashion yourself, were you involved in this kind of activity, to be a great artist of that sort. And I think that's certainly quite appealing. And there's a real vision of authenticity, being true to yourself and true to your vocation and true to your calling.
You can see how this would appeal to an adolescent male.
Oh, absolutely. And it also fits in, you know, for all her shunning of the literary norms and what, you know, other people were doing, it also fits in with a certain critique in the 50s that you see, the man in the gray flannel suit, The Lonely Crowd, David Riesman's book, Vance Packer's Status Seekers, because it's all about trying to be an authentic, true self, true to oneself amidst this gray morass of capitalism. And in some ways, she's, like I said, she's quite the critic of a certain kind of corporate culture. And I think to that extent, she really anticipates the whole, you know, entrepreneurial ethos that you see, you know, giving rise to in the 70s and the 80s and with Reaganism and so forth.
And her vision is very gendered, isn't it? It's all about strong men.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, women, the role of the woman is ultimately there are a couple of heroic, very strong women, but ultimately their destiny is to fall before the weight of this strong man and to stand by his side.
Except for the author herself.
Exactly.
I'm speaking with Corey Robin, who teaches at Brooklyn College and has a review, a recent issue of The Nation, of a couple of biographies of Ayn Rand. And I haven't said anything about those biographies. What do you make of them?
Well, I had mixed feelings about them. I mean, I felt like they both had a lot of useful information that I hadn't seen before. One of them in particular made connections between Rand and the sort of intellectual history of the American right. But I felt like, you know, this is a danger with a lot of the books that are we've seen of late about re-examining the right and realizing its significance. And I consider myself one of the scholars who's engaged in that endeavor, is that they sometimes end up drinking the Kool-Aid and taking certain of these writers far more seriously than they ought to be. Ayn Rand was not a great thinker, and she was not a great novelist. But if you read these two books, they both act as if that were the case. And I give a bunch of examples in my review of just, you know, where they just buy into her own PR, oftentimes to their own embarrassment, and really betray a certain kind of ignorance of larger intellectual, philosophical, political, and literary traditions.
Well, yeah, talking about her role in the American right, I remember back in my day as a brief member of that formation, we didn't like her. And there was a famous denunciation of her that Whitaker Chambers wrote in National Review.
Yeah.
And said there was something about her that said, "To the gas chambers go." And you, of course, talked about a certain degree of fascism underlying her thought. Could you talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think we need to be careful here because, you know, you throw around the word fascism and it raises a lot of people's gets people's hackles going. And it's a very easy charge to make. So what I say is that if you look at not her policy positions by any stretch, and certainly not her formal affiliations or anything like that. She was, you know, definitively against Nazism and fascism in every form. But if you look at what I call the moral syntax of the way she thinks about the world, the deep structure – well, I use the word deep structure advisedly. There's not much that's deep there, but the structure of her thought, what's underneath the surface insofar as there is anything underneath there – she has a conception. She claims that it's rooted in Aristotle, and I won't bore readers with your listeners with the details of that. It has nothing to do with Aristotle. But she had a conception that all morality
– Had she really read Aristotle?
No. I mean, well, she certainly had the, you know, Aristotle in her shelf, and according to one of her biographers, there's evidence that she did read Aristotle. But the references and the invocations of Aristotle were either false, and you can't find it anywhere in Aristotle, or it was sort of a misapplication of certain of his ideas, which she got really lambasted about this from several influential, Sidney Hook for one, and Robert Nozick, who was a libertarian himself, was, you know, very uncomfortable by her sort of Aristotelian invocations. But
do they sell a 500,000 copies?
No. But what is in her thought is this idea that moral rights and wrongs derive from the world of nature. And there's certain about that Aristotle certainly agreed with. This is very much opposed to the Kantian position. Kant said that, you know, morality is essentially separated from our physicality, from our natural essence. Morality is in some ways the triumph over our natural essence. Rand wanted to derive it from our natural essence. But her vision of nature is very much this kind of Darwinian struggle for survival, which you don't
see. That's something that has to be subdued by the heroic capitalist, right?
Absolutely. Well, both subdued and also harnessed at the same time, you know. he's engaged in that kind of struggle himself and must do. In essence, she sees every moral choice we make is a question of whether or not it promotes your life or your death. And she means it quite literally, life and death. And I think what I found in her writing is it's not the life part that's so interesting or appealing or exciting to her. It's the death part. It's that sense that you're always triumphing over that ultimate night that exists. And I make some – if you look literally at the words that both Goebbels and Hitler use when they describe their conception of the moral world, it's almost identical. Now, their conception of who the agent is our collectives, the state, versus the individual. But if you take it then a next step further, which I do in the article, if you look at their economic writings, and people – nobody ever really looks at the Nazis' economic writings such as they are. They very much have this very sense – the celebration of the heroic individual. Hitler particularly in his speeches in Dusseldorf and before various businessmen oftentimes will talk about the heroic individual as the driving force of the economy. And again, with Rand, you see the exact same thing. So it's both the valorization of death and life as the measure and yardstick of morality, but then also this celebration of the heroic individual as the one who both drives the economy and for which all of us should be grateful, too.
Now, I used to be on the press release list for the Ayn Rand Institute, which that's, I guess, an offspring of one branch of her following, right? Yeah. And I was just amazed how frequently they were in love with military power and the use of, you know, state violence to promote their ends. You know, it's like they're not much for limited government when it comes to that.
No, which is interesting. You know, she was against the Vietnam War, and I have to say she did, on that score at least, was quite critical of the military. I mean, she didn't have a priori critique of, you know, the military-industrial complex, but she certainly was not, at least formally, in favor of war. I think the genius of Ayn Rand, and I think this is – I didn't really get into this in the article, but – you know, historically, on the right, there's been this tension between commerce and war. The Enlightenment celebrated commerce and commercial values as the triumph over militarism. It would pacify society and create a more equitable, peaceful kind of society. So there's always been this tension on the right. And I think the genius of writers like Ayn Rand and other writers on the right, on the economic right, I think in particular of Hayek and Schumpeter, is that they managed to reascribe those militaristic values through economic activity, to find in economic activity an expression of warrior values. And you see, you know,
well, even Cain said something to the effect, it's better someone lorded over his checkbook than over his fellow man.
Exactly. No, I mean, that was the traditional idea, was that, you know, it would pacify it. But these guys take the reverse route, which is that they want to revive those warrior values, but just see them expressed through economic activity. And I think, you know, and fascism, believe it or not, you know, when they talk about the economy, you see a very similar kind of discussion going on there.
We're just about out of time, but I'm guessing now that we have a socialist Taha in the White House, these must be good times for Rand's sales and her reputation.
Absolutely. You know, it's really taken off in the last couple of years. I mean, thanks in part to Glenn Beck. He's always sort of pushing her ideas on his show. And, it's been a huge, you know, huge boon time for her.
Now, is this an infantile disorder, or people continue with their infatuation with Rand into adulthood?
They certainly do continue it. I mean, those two things aren't mutually exclusive. they, you know, absolutely. I've gotten so much, email and hate mail from adults. You know, many of them have degrees and things of that sort. So, and she, you know, it should be said, I didn't talk about this. She has a small but growing academic following. It's centered around the University of Pittsburgh, of all places. And there's a book by a woman who's at the University of Texas Philosophy Department, which actually was quite good, on Ayn Rand's ethics, where she makes the strongest case for the seriousness of her thought. I think her case fails, but, you know, there are some smart people who...
Well, there's a guy at NYU who's a student of Bertel Ullman's, Chris Shabara, too, who said she was a dialectician.
Yes, out of the Russian tradition.
Yeah, very strange stuff. Is a lot of the rest of the right kind of suspicious of her?
I'm sorry, what's that?
How much of the rest of the right is suspicious of her or uncomfortable with her?
You know, I think today this is changing quite a bit. I think in her time, the right was, you know, the traditionalist right, the National Review, you know, she was really excoriated over there and William F. Buckley wrote a particularly kind of nasty obituary when she died. So the sort of that traditionalist Christian right has always been very wary of her. You mentioned Whitaker Chambers. I think that my sense is that that's diminishing quite a bit. One of the authors had a interesting blog over at Dissent a few months ago, where she said that, you know, what we're seeing on the right today is the revival of a kind of free market populism that really got submerged during the Bush years with the, you know, the kind of the Christian right and compassionate conservatism. You're really seeing in the Tea Party the revival of this kind of, you know, free market populism, and it's really her moment now.
Well, that's a hearty perennial in the American right, though, isn't it? All right, thank you for joining us. I've been speaking with Corey Robin, who teaches at Brooklyn College, and we didn't get a chance to discuss Antonin Scalia, so we can do that at some future date. All right, let's take a break, and we'll be back to talk about housing.
Hi, this is Gil Scott here, an unknown bluesologist, speaking to you on Free Speech Radio, WBAI 99.5 on your radio dial. Stay here.
Marhaba, I'm Barbara Nimri-Aziz. Sunday from 5 to 6 p.m., July 18th, WBAI airs the first in a series focusing on Iran and Iraq. We'll be looking at America's recent history with these countries and strategies used to subdue them. So please join us. That's this Sunday, July 18th, from 5 to 6 p.m. on WBAI 99.5 FM in New York.
And this is WBAI, not only at 99.5 FM on your radio dial, but also on the web at WBAI.org. And if you visit the website, hit that donate button. We could always use your help. Okay, let's take a musical break, and we'll be back to talk housing. And that was some of the Piano Trio No. 7, The Archduke, first movement by Beethoven, performed by Daniel Barenboim, Jacqueline Dupre, and Pinchas Zuberman. And we are now joined in the studio by Alyssa Katz, who is the author of the book Our Lot, which is a history of American housing and our relations to real estate, residential real estate, and our crazy national policies about these things, the housing bubble and the housing bust, and now just out in paperback, right?
That's right.
With some new material?
A little bit.
Oh, you have to talk it up a little
bit. I know. No, just a lot. Yeah, I mean, what I do in the paperback is talk about this fitful financial reform process and how little it's really accomplished so far. I mean, you know, just today the financial reform bill moved forward, and it's a very big deal and includes some pretty significant strides forward, like the establishment of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. But the sort of fundamental dynamics that exist in the economy around housing and that really cause the bubble aren't being addressed at all. And so the afterword and the paperback really looks at what are those things and what can be done to deal with them, and why aren't they being dealt with.
And the Financial Times reporting that a lot of the big investment banks are building up their mortgage-backed securities desks again after having cut back during the bust. It's back to business as usual all over again.
Yeah, that's right. And that's what we're pretty much doing, is replicating exactly the same mortgage economy that existed before. And in fact, with one difference, which is that the role of what have really been the market makers of Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, of government-regulated, chartered, and mission-driven agencies, you know, they've really been crippled. I mean, right now they are backing the majority of mortgages, but if this momentum behind private securitization continues, and there's no reason to think that it won't, then we're going to see, I think, a lot of the same patterns we've seen in the past with redlining, that is the exclusion of entire communities or groups of borrowers from access to mortgages, because the marketplace just won't have actors who have obligations to meet those needs.
Well, it seems like in this world, it's either feast or famine. You know, you have like redlining, people excluded completely from credit, and at the other end, you get these crazy speculative infusions of capital that lead to overbuilding and overbuying, and which ends in a terrible bust. Is there any way of approaching a happy medium?
Well, yeah, I mean, and this is the way we've done it for quite a long time, which is to really have regulated actors who, you have to remember that before the 1980s, you couldn't just create securities out of home mortgages. It was after the Depression. I've talked about this on your show before, and talk about this in great depth in our lot. New Deal reforms in the Great Depression really made it very difficult to take mortgages and turn them into speculative investments. And it was only through deregulation in the 80s that it became possible and that this industry emerged. And so I think it's, the very obvious thing to do is to go back to that juncture in history and figure out a different way forward. But instead, we're basically rebuilding this machinery that really does, first and foremost, encourage that kind of speculative investment and sees it as economically healthy.
Well, but the old model you're talking about is almost like a utility, a financial equivalent of a utility. It's tightly regulated, and you can make some money doing it, but people don't make scads of money doing it. And, of course, Wall Street would not be at all happy.
Right. No, exactly. And, at the same time, that possibility of that model is very much on the table among folks both in the policy world and in the sort of more conscientious corners of the banking industry, who kind of understand that the history of this utility model had a lot of benefits and a lot of successes, particularly when it came to making capital broadly available. And, recognition and track record came out of the Community Reinvestment Act, came out of a lot of very painful efforts to deal with the fact that the financial industry had basically abandoned large parts of the country, primarily inner cities, but other places as well. And the sort of effort between organizers and bankers and legislators to figure out, well, how do we make sure the banking system serves those needs? So, what we have got now is, a dynamic where the market quite likely is not going to meet those needs because, for one thing, and this is, I think going to become a bigger issue in the next couple of years, is that the Community Reinvestment Act doesn't cover mortgage-backed securities. It covers financial institutions and their lending made from their own portfolios. But this mortgage-backed securities business that is now revving up again, as the Financial Times reported, has no obligations to serve anyone. They just basically buy whatever mortgages they want to buy and get whatever investors they can to buy those.
But let's since you mentioned the Community Reinvestment Act, let's deal with a canard on the right, which, of course, blames the CRA for having created the housing problem.
Well, right. I mean, it just couldn't be less true for the very reason that I just described. I mean, the Community Reinvestment Act, passed in 1977, obligates financial institutions to meet the credit needs of their communities. And one of the ways this is evaluated, and there are many, is whether it is making loans in the same communities in which it takes an institution is making loans in the same communities in which it takes deposits. Well, that made sense when deposits were the primary way that financial institutions financed home lending. But with mortgage securitization, private market securitization being the main way that mortgages get financed, the Community Reinvestment Act doesn't apply to that entire market. So all of those subprime loans, that entire the entire bubble of activity that was at the center of the mortgage crisis was completely outside of the scope of a Community Reinvestment Act, and it really had nothing to do with it. So it's really just it's become this canard that has just come front and center, but it's simply not true.
Speaking with Alyssa Katz, who is the author of Our Lot, which is just out in paperback. And who's the publisher?
Bloomsbury.
Bloomsbury. People always ask who's the publisher is. So now I'm helping them out. Speaking of canards, another canard is that there is an epidemic now of people walking away from mortgages that they could pay, but they just don't feel like it. Strategic defaults. And there's even a theory circulating on Wall Street a few months back that the brief pop we saw earlier in the year in retail sales was financed by people who were not paying their mortgages and just buying stuff instead. What do you think of that?
Well, I think of it is less important right now than what Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac think of it, which is, I think that both of these as the major holders of mortgages that that homeowners have right now are saying that they're going to crack down on people who decide to stop paying their mortgages. And they have determined that they are somehow going to make a distinction between those who are suffering genuine hardship and cannot pay and those who really are just choosing to do this for economic reasons.
And how can they tell the difference?
Well, that's really the big question. They're saying that if a borrower doesn't make a good faith effort to contact their bill collector who's trying to get payments, if they don't seek a mortgage modification, that this is a sign that they are a calculating strategic defaulter as opposed to someone with a true hardship. And this is extremely problematic because you're basically asking the very borrower who was set up with a mortgage they now cannot pay to go back to the same lender or an agent for that same lender and then ask them for help. And the help that's on offer is, even under the federal programs to assist borrowers, is incredibly inadequate and not appropriate for most situations.
Has anything come of these government programs?
Some. I mean, there are borrowers who have been able, in some numbers, if I think it's in the tens of thousands, maybe over 100,000 right now, who have, because of lowered monthly payments through interest rate reductions and through deferred payments and other ways of rearranging payment schedules, have been able to month to month hold on to their homes.
But now there could be something like a million foreclosures this year, so this is a small fraction of the problem.
It's a small fraction of the problem, and it also, even for those borrowers who are staying afloat right now, it just kicks the can down the road because they're not, by and large, getting principal reduction. Nothing obligates a lender to reduce the amount of principal owed. And there are a couple of new Obama administration initiatives that are providing incentives for principal reduction, but it's really unclear and quite unlikely, honestly, that lenders are actually going to take those incentives.
Now, it must be said that these proposals for some sort of forbearance or forgiveness or restructuring are quite unpopular with a lot of the public because people say, I pay my mortgage, why should somebody else get a break?
Right. I think it's more unpopular when there's a perception that that government aid is in fact going to those individuals and that they're getting cash bailouts. But yeah, there's a big political problem with that. And there's also this sort of deeper reality underlying that of moral hazard, of the idea that indeed if lenders are required to give principal reductions on any large scale, that homeowners will simply abandon their mortgages en masse or demand these principal reductions en masse. And that has clearly huge implications for the financial institutions and investors with a stake in those mortgages. And so I think there's a lot of fear among policymakers at Treasury about what the consequences would be. So when they have encouraged principal reduction, it's been on a very small scale and to extremely limited numbers of borrowers.
And actually, I don't do this very often, but it seems I bet a lot of listeners might be in this situation. If people are having trouble paying the mortgage, what should they do?
Well, the first thing to do is to find a HUD-approved counselor who can help you evaluate your options and figure out whether you qualify for one of the mortgage modification programs. And for some people, they're genuinely helpful if a situation is a temporary, unemployment setback, a health problem, and the issue is just staying afloat until you can recover and pay the bills, then that can be extremely helpful. I think that the options for those for whom that doesn't make sense once they've evaluated that are more limited, but and I'm not advising this to listeners at home, but you should know that New York and California, where many of your listeners are both what are known as non-recourse states, meaning that if homeowners do decide, you know what, this just doesn't make sense, I owe way too much, I can't pay it, forget about it, and you stop paying, the lender cannot come after the borrower for the amount they owe. That's it. You lost your home and all of your other assets are protected. In some others, many other states, that's not the case. And this is just getting back to what we were talking about before, why Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac right now are so worried about strategic defaults and why Treasury is also very, very worried that about this possibility that borrowers will just walk away en masse. And that's because in some states there are very few repercussions other than a hit to one's credit score. And so this is why recently
And not being able to get a mortgage for about 4 or 7 years afterwards.
Well, previously that wasn't necessarily – it wasn't officially the case. Yes, one is quite likely going to have difficulty getting a mortgage. But until about a month ago Fannie Mae sort of made it official. They said, okay, from now on, no more Mr. Nice Guy. We are going to figure out who's a strategic defaulter, and those borrowers are – we're going to go after them for everything they owe, no matter where you live. I don't know how they do that in a non-recourse state like New York. And then also, you cannot get a mortgage backed by us for another 7 years, and which sort of suggests, that this wasn't policy before, and but in a sense, it wasn't. The sort of need to keep the customer pool deep and markets as broad as possible, I think, really did in the past make industry players like Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac hesitate to say that anyone was going to be off limits from lending. And now they're starting to say, you know what, here's a penalty you'll have to pay.
Well, the mortgage market is in very bad shape right now. I think applications, according to the Mortgage Bankers Association's indexes, are at a record low. The market is, the housing market looked like it was recovering a couple of months ago. Now it looks like it's sinking back again with the expiration of the home buyer's credit. What's your prognosis for the housing market?
Well, I mean, you mentioned the home buyer's tax credit. I mean, that credit basically took the next year or two of demand and front-loaded it, right? So you have an immediate situation in which demand is extremely weak. But I do think that over time into the future, and so much of this really depends on some decisions that have yet to be made about the shape of the housing finance system. If that housing finance system comes back in a robust form, I think that the housing market will in many markets stabilize. I think others like Las Vegas and really overbuilt exurbs and so on, it's much more vulnerable. But central to this is this question of what happens to Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, which is going to be the big political circus that is just getting underway right now. And it's really
Now, what is their status? They're nationalized, right?
They're under conservatorship. We don't use the N-word
right.
about Fannie.
But they effectively nationalized.
They're effectively nationalized, and they are it basically means also that Treasury is liable for what the Congressional Budget Office now calculates is about $163 billion in liabilities net over the next 10 years or so. And what it means is that they are under the thumb of a federal regulator, the Federal Housing Finance Agency, and pretty much have ceased to function as, they function pretty much as kind of maintainers of what is a sizable chunk of the mortgage market, but they can't really do anything new, create new products, go into new lines of business.
And I imagine there are a lot of people who would love to see them privatized. Is that a live option?
It may well be. I don't think the administration wants to see them privatized. So much of this depends on Congress and what it does. Fannie and Freddie are both chartered agencies, and I believe that Congress has to weigh in on that. And, the sort of the misinformation and confusion about the Fannie and Freddie's role in the crisis, and more broadly about the risks and problems of having strong government involvement in the mortgage markets, really threatens to cloud how this all goes down and goes down in Congress.
I see we're running a little low on time, and I do want to get to this topic, which is what's going on with public housing policy, the federal government looking to privatize it?
Yeah. It's what the federal government is doing is trying to find new sources of money, and they're turning to the private sector for the first time to do that. Historically, public housing has only been able to get direct government funding.
So Jack Kemp didn't get to do that.
No, and he probably wanted to. And I think Clinton's folks tried to figure it out too, but politically it wasn't really possible. But public housing has suffered tremendously from budget cuts over the past 10, 15 years that have left a lot of projects in really terrible physical shape. And it's just created a very desperate situation.
And public housing is mostly financed by the federal government.
It's almost entirely. Some is financed by state governments, but almost entirely. And with shrinking budgets, like literally projects are not only falling apart, but in many cases being demolished. So in the interest
of— you had this piece where the city of Newark didn't even have the money to demolish it now.
That's right. They don't even have the money to demolish it. They're just completely – and this is true in many, many cities. So the idea is and again, Congress would have to buy into this – is that cities can turn to the private mortgage market and borrow funds against these assets. And what's really huge here is not just that private funding is coming into the mix and these could potentially go into foreclosure, or you have things like that, but also that this is really about taking this government asset and unleashing all this equity that's in there. It's really billions of dollars in assets to the private marketplace as an investment.
But these are buildings which are rather dilapidated, not always in very nice neighborhoods, and the residents don't have a lot of money. So what would the attraction be to private capital?
Well, it really depends, but this is already happening here in New York City where you have public housing projects in Chelsea and other high—
Well, our public housing is in pretty good shape compared to the rest of the country.
It is. But remember, the HUD secretary is from New York and has New York very centrally on his mind. And I think other high-cost markets have a very similar situation where public housing is on some very valuable real estate and this asset can be leveraged. And remember, the construction doesn't have to happen on site. You can leverage the asset and then, you know, get a mortgage and do the construction elsewhere if you package the project right. So what you have ultimately is a lot of pressure. The other reason there's a lot of pressure on public housing is just that this is unlike the government funding, which is in theory indefinite. It's permanently affordable, permanently public housing. To privatize and get private investors, they would have to limit the time frame for affordability officially, right? To say that this is going to be affordable housing for 20 years or 30 years, and then at that point, that investor—
The poor people are out of the street.
In theory. I mean, HUD's saying, right, that they will have all kinds of protections and incentives, and governments wouldn't want to do that. And,
No.
In fact, we already know what happens because we've had many years of experience with Section 8, which offers, you know, which has contracts with housing, for affordable housing in cities across the country. And when those contracts expire, some of those have gone to market rate as well, and we've lost hundreds of thousands of units of affordable housing in the process.
The administration essentially is looking to privatize a good deal of public housing stock.
They wouldn't say they're privatizing it. They would say they are looking to the private market for capital. But yes, I mean, in effect, it could result in the eventual privatization of those buildings.
Well, if the idea is saving money, then it's not going to be too good for the poor residents.
Potentially, I will say in HUD's favor, it could be very good in that the funds raised could really pay for some very nice improvements to their property. I mean, the places I visited in Newark were hellholes. I mean, people need the housing and treasure it as their community, but they're in very, very bad shape. These funds are needed. Should they come from government? Yes, absolutely. Is there a huge price to pay in 30 years for taking it out from the private sector? Yes, we should be prepared for that. But in the short term, it's going to result in very beautiful improvements to a lot of public housing properties.
And what about giving the current residents vouchers and telling them to go have their luck with the private market?
Well, that's part of the plan, too. One part of the new agenda is to, in fact, give every public housing resident a choice after they live in public housing for a couple of years. Stay here or take a voucher. It's up to you. And this has a lot of public housing authorities very concerned that it could really result in a lot of churning and instability and a lot of problems for the residents as well.
Well, and then how receptive is the private market to these vouchers? Can people find places to live that the voucher covers?
Yeah, I mean, it's very often difficult. I mean, landlords discriminate pretty rampantly against Section 8 voucher holders. HUD does have pretty strict standards on what kinds of condition the buildings need to be in, but you really have people taking their chances in the private market and also losing all the supports they had when public housing, you know, is in one place and has resources on site and so on. It becomes a very different situation once people get dispersed.
And just finally, now we are, you know, at the tail end, I hope, of this worst crisis in the housing market since the 1930s. It seems like we've learned close to nothing from it.
Yeah, it would seem that way. I think that the lessons are pretty clear to everyone who thinks closely about it, but the problem is that we basically have two societies now economically. You have the owners whose property values must be protected at all costs or stakes in those investments and mortgages must be invested and protected at all costs. And then you have everyone else who are kind of shut out. Right. And I think the problem is that policymaking has all been focused on protecting those asset values to the exclusion of broader reform. And I think that we have to get beyond things like the tax credit and other policies that protect asset values to fundamental reform that makes sure this doesn't happen again.
All right. Well, let's hope so. But that's not the way the USA works, is it? All right. I'm speaking with Alyssa Katz, who is the author of Our Lot, just out in paperback from Bloomsbury. A very fine and important book it is. Okay, that's it for me, Doug Henwood. I'll be back next week. And let's go out with this from MIA's new album. This is called Love a Lot. Till next week. Bye.
They told me this is a free country. But now it feels like a chicken factory. Still could talk about one of us, wait. Got nothing to lose if you get me. Like a Taliban trucker eating boiled up yucca. Get my eyes down like I'm in a black bird. I've been free sh- yeah, it's a but now I make tunes say shaka-laka-laka. Shaka-laka-la, shaka-laka-lee. Shaka-laka-laka-laka-laka-laka-laka-me. If you check me, I check you. If they kick you, then I back you.